KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. In 1971, when sound designer Jim Lebrecht was 15, he had a summer of love kind of experience at a camp for disabled kids, a place that fostered a spirit of history-changing activism. He shared his memories with his friend, filmmaker Nicole Noonan, and they agreed this could make a good movie. They didn't anticipate that some VIP backers would think so too.
What a sentence to be able to say. We knew we could partner with the Obamas, Barack and Michelle.
It does still sound pretty amazing, you know, every time we say it.
This week, we're revisiting our conversation with co-directors Noonan and Lebrecht, who was born with spina bifida and uses a wheelchair. They tell us about making their Netflix film Crip Camp, which is now Oscar-nominated for Best Documentary. But first, an all-new special Oscars banter for this strangest of award seasons. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my special award season banter buddy, Scott Feinberg of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Scott.
Hey, thanks for having me.
A pleasure. I don't know if the award season has been a pleasure this year. You are normally running all over the place. I don't know. Have you run anywhere or have you done a pretty much totally virtual Zoom award season?
Yeah, no, it's been very weird to go through not only just an award season, but the longest award season ever without actually having to leave my apartment. So in some ways that's been nice. You know, you don't have to schlep around. But in some ways, of course, it's a bit depressing to not see the people that you're actually covering every day. So it's very weird.
Yeah, I mean, part of what you're doing here is forecasting. A lot of what you're doing is forecasting. And I don't know, do you feel like you can get the same vibe? Even, I mean, I know sometimes you go to Academy screenings and you feel the Academy reacting to a movie, and that's not something you could do. Do you feel like that's cost you and the crystal ball is a little cloudier?
I think so. I mean, and it's not just the Academy screenings. It's that at various events or lunches or all kinds of things, you kind of just gather normally a sense of how members are thinking or what they're watching. Or, you know, the thing this year is that they're not having those conversations, which I think has made it harder for even them to decide what to watch, if anything. And we've, you know, I had a conversation with one Academy member recently who said, you know, this year the top contender is apathy because, you know, these guys are not even that gung-ho to watch movies without a clear kind of consensus about which are important for them to watch. And plus, they've got a lot of other concerns on their mind.
Yeah. Well, we really kind of got off, if I'm looking at the Golden Globes as the first event that happened. And this year was a mess. And then a massive drop off in ratings, which must have the Academy extremely nervous.
Yeah, I think that by this point, having seen the massive decline in ratings for all award shows in the pandemic era, whether it's the Grammys or the Golden Globes or anything else, I think the Academy has sort of accepted the reality that no matter what kind of a show they put on, it's probably going to have very low and probably record low ratings. You know, part of that is also probably due to the fact that very few people have seen movies in theaters. These movies this year that are nominated are also, of course, available on streaming services, but they don't release their viewership figures. And there's some reason to believe that, you know, even though they are probably more widely accessible than ever, they are not being watched as much as in a usual year. And so that is the main thing that historically determines the viewership of the Oscars. If you look back, you see that Avatar, the year of Avatar, the year of Titanic, those were the highest rated Oscars just because people felt they had a rooting interest. And this year, I'm not sure that's the case.
Now let's talk about that show. You know, it started out, the producers, Steven Soderbergh, Jesse Collins, Stacey Scherer, sort of laid down some law that we're going to be in person and you better dress nicely and all of this. And I guess that didn't go over that well.
No, I mean, you've got a lot of nominees this year. I mean, just about half the acting nominees are based outside of the United States. And then there's a ton of others, you know, people all over the place who are in very different phases of dealing with the pandemic than we are in the United States, where it's still not great, but, you know, a lot of Europe is now locked down again because of a surge. And so the idea that you're going to tell people who may never have been and may never again be Oscar nominated, that they can't participate in the show unless they're there in person, when that's not even an option, that obviously engendered some backlash. And so the Academy producers that who you mentioned, they organized a Zoom call with the nominees, essentially saying, look, we hear you. We're going to do our best to accommodate as many of you as possible by setting up hubs, is the word they use, sort of venues in places like England and Paris and perhaps others as well, where there are a concentration of nominees, so that those people will still be visibly on the telecast, if not in LA itself. And then they're going to do their best to also help address another concern, which is that even if people can get to the Los Angeles venue, they are going to be required to quarantine for a significant number of days on either side of that, which comes with a cost that not all of them personally can assume and not all studios want to assume. And so the Academy suggested that they will have partners like airlines and hotels who will assume some of that cost. But look, when you insist on doing things in person in the middle of a pandemic, there are risks and costs that are associated with that. So it's a very bizarre situation.
But they did make a point of no PJs if you're getting there by Zoom or whatever, right? They want you to dress nicely and not make it that.
Yeah, because they do want to keep the Oscars a little more elevated above these other shows. You know, it's not the Golden Globes where you can show up and get drunk. It's not the Critics' Choice Awards where it's not going to change your life one way or the other. This is still the Oscars, and they want it to be treated as, you know, the most special of award shows.
Now, we have seen, because of the pandemic, partly, of course, this record number of streamers that are in the chase this time. You know, there are those who would look at that and say, the shift has happened and Hollywood is completely ready to embrace movies on streamers. Or you could say this is a pandemic year and it's going to go back with a little bit of that prejudice still lingering. And not just prejudice. I mean, I think, you know, Matt Bellany and I have talked about how theatrical is the showcase for movies that you can't really replicate on a streaming platform.
Totally. And I have heard that there are some cinematographers, for instance, who are going to abstain from voting this year because they feel that they're not able to properly judge a movie unless they see it on a big screen. There are others who plan to abstain because they just haven't seen enough movies this year. They didn't want to watch them that way. I think, you know, not that the Academy will ever acknowledge it, but I think we'll probably have, in terms of percentage of voters, possibly one of the lowest voter participation years ever because of all these different reasons. But I think also at the same time, it's hard to say that there is a passionate, enthusiastic bias against Netflix, for instance, when they this year accrued more nominations than only two other years on record, the most recent being the year that of 2003, recognizing films from 2002, when Miramax had something like 40. I think Netflix this year had 35 or 36. Yes, there were not a lot of theatrical releases this year, but you know, they've made a stand this year. They acquired from Paramount, for instance, Trial of Chicago 7, which is one of two movies they have nominated for Best Picture. So I think that we're not going to go back to conversations about will Netflix be shunned by the Academy because it's Netflix. I think that for better or worse, this expedited things for both of those situations faster than they would have otherwise happened.
So I'm not gonna make you do too many predictions, although that is what you do, Scott. You do predictions, yep. But we'll have you do a few predictions. But we're gonna note that this is still a fluid thing, and as we've seen not that long ago, you can get some real shockers when it comes to the final, the Oscar goes to. But I will go out way on a limb and say it looks like a very good year for Nomadland. Am I wrong?
It does. I mean, it's won everything up to this point that usually are harbingers for Best Picture. And it's got seven fellow nominees that it's competing with on the preferential ballot that has sometimes thrown a wrench in things because the Academy, again, uses this ranked system that none of the other awards but the Producers Guild use. So there's always a chance that, you know, with that voting system, a sort of compromised choice can emerge. I think that's probably what happened, for instance, the year that Green Book beat Roma. There were a lot of extenuating circumstances that year. But so, you know, if it's not Nomadland, it would probably be Trial of Chicago 7, because that is, again, it's been heavily campaigned. It's sort of a middle ground movie. But I would have to say that at this point, Nomadland and its director, Chloe Zhao, look very strong.
I think actress is a little trickier, maybe.
Yeah, it's really interesting because obviously if people love Nomadland as much as they appear to, then you can't rule out the whole movie revolves around Frances McDormand, but she has won two Best Actress Oscars before. So some people feel like that makes people less inclined to vote for her and maybe more inclined to go for somebody like Carey Mulligan for A Promising Young Woman who has never won. So Carey Mulligan right now is sort of the odds on favorite, but I don't think anyone would be shocked that Frances McDormand pulled out a third win, which for females, only Katharine Hepburn and Meryl Streep can claim to have three or more acting awards.
Yeah, for what it's worth, which is literally nothing, I would feel it's Frances McDormand just because she is so much the heart of the movie. But then again, yeah, maybe people have Frances McDormand award fatigue. We'll see. Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Scott Feinberg. He's the Hollywood Reporter's awards columnist and host of the Awards Chatter podcast. Jim Labrecht is co-director of the Oscar-nominated Netflix documentary Crip Camp, and he's also one of the film's subjects.
I wanted to be part of the world, but I didn't see anyone like me in it.
I hear about a summer camp for the handicapped run by hippies. Somebody said you probably will smoke dope with the counselors, and I'm like, sign me up.
Going to Camp Jeanette in upstate New York in the early 1970s changed the then 15-year-old Labrecht's life, and he wasn't the only one who had that experience. Crip Camp offers a trove of archival footage showing something that was rare for disabled teenagers, the freedom just to be kids. There was swimming, singing, and hooking up. The spirit of Camp Jeanette would be a spark that later lit a fire of disability activism as a group of former campers found themselves living as young adults in and around Berkeley. There, led by former camper Judy Heumann, activists fought for the very first federal protections for people with disabilities. We originally spoke with Jim Labrecht and his friend and co-director, Nicole Noonan, last year from a studio in Oakland, just days before the Bay Area instituted strict shelter-at-home rules. But even then, it was clear that the film's rollout would be disrupted. They had already had to cancel travel abroad for some planned screenings in Europe.
It's tough, but we are glad that the film will be out there for people to watch at home, even if, you know, they can't congregate in theaters to see it. But we just came back from True False in Missouri and had some really spectacular screenings for, you know, sort of 1,700-person theaters. And we had this amazing set of screenings at Sundance. So we feel lucky compared to so many people who are really, really suffering, who are trying to get films out in the world right now.
True. Netflix is probably, I don't know how many options you had or considered, but, well, tell me how many options you had and considered.
Well, we had several options, and we were really attracted to the idea of Netflix because of the broad global reach of it, of the platform. For us, the idea that the film could be, you know, accessible and reach people all over the world with this story, which is such an important story that we really feel passionately about people coming to know, was really exciting. And then when, you know, Higher Ground became interested as well, and we knew we could partner with the Obamas and their company, then that became, you know, a really, really exciting option.
What a sentence to be able to say. We knew we could partner with the Obamas, Barack and Michelle.
It does still sound pretty amazing, you know, every time we say it to us, too.
So let's just step back a bit to the beginning. I have to say, Jim, the footage view as a little boy, as a little boy, is the most adorable thing I've seen. What an amazing kid you were.
Well, that's really nice of you to say. I think, first off, I'm amazed that my dad shot all of this stuff and that we were actually able to kind of use it for the film. And I don't know, my Aunt Jeanette always kind of told me that she thought there was something about me that was just amazing, that I just could figure things out and wasn't going to let anything stop me. And you can kind of see it in those home movies.
Yes, you see this adorable child who has spina bifida, as you did, and you are figuring out how to do one thing after another with this huge smile on your face. You then, I don't know, I'm not sure whether you were brought up in an environment, you know, this is a conversation that is big among the campers at the camp and, you know, how protective are the parents and what do the parents let you do or what are they scared to let you do? I don't know how your experience was growing up.
Well, I don't think my parents were not overprotective. they definitely kept an eye out for me. But I think that I was, it was kind of a partnership that I was showing them that I was fairly capable of stuff and wasn't liable to get myself into trouble. And that they had a good sense that for me to succeed, I had to be out in the real world. So I don't recall anything like how some of the other campers talk about in the film about their parents not wanting them to do something because they were afraid that I would be disappointed. Fortunately, that was just not part of my life and my upbringing.
Yes. So you get to go to this camp, this camp where it all happens. It's all going on at the camp. And even if you have never been to this particular kind of camp, it's anybody who lived in that era, it's like a nostalgia fest watching a bunch of basically hippie kids being young hippies.
Yeah, you don't really see folks with disabilities really being represented in this way. We were just, a bunch of kids in this incredible time in history, just being kids and really exploring what life could be all about.
So someone comes to, I get the impression, and I was doing, you know, some reading, some kind of hippie filmmakers come and basically attach a camera to what, to a, I'm not, how did that work? So that you were shooting footage yourself?
I mean, yeah, they, you could see in the footage, they all have very long hair and beards. And I think they were definitely part of the culture there. And I was drawn to anything that like was like audio or video or anything. And while they were there one day, they said, let's just strap the tape deck to the back of your handlebars in your chair and give you the camera and we'll just push you around camp and let's do a camp tour.
They were called the People's Video Theater, and they were an early radical video coalition that were in a station wagon when they stopped at a gas station and met a van full of hippie kids from Camp Jened with disabilities and hippie counselors. And the Jenedian folks said, hey, you know, man, what is that equipment? You should come over and film the Camp Olympics tomorrow. And so they got there and the camp was shut down and they couldn't get in. So they dropped some acid and, you know, hung out for a couple of hours. And then eventually the gates of the camp opened and they walked in, and that was the middle of the crabs epidemic.
Wait, you want me to tell them what happened? Well, two people got crabs and they're spreading.
We were all very hyper about it. And I have to go shower some people.
I said it was all like, going on at the camp.
Yeah. So they just turned on their cameras and started filming, and they stayed for several days. And it was kind of a miracle that, 50 years later, Jim and I decided to try to make a film about the camp, and we were able to track down two of the founders of the People's Video Theater, and Howard Gutstadt and Ben Levine, and they lived in the Bay Area just a couple of miles from us, and we're midway through transferring all the footage when we contacted them. It was just incredible.
So they were digitizing this, and Jim, you had been thinking, I think, if I have this right, that you, that this would be a great subject for a movie.
Well, Nicole and I have been friends for a long time, and we had a lunch one day, and I've been her sound designer for three of her feature-length documentaries, and was pitching her a bunch of ideas around disability. And I thought, you know, there's a story here about my summer camp and these people that moved from New York out to the Bay Area, and thought that there might be this connection to a greater piece of history here.
I'm a filmmaker who loves history, and I love movement storytelling. And so I was instantly really attracted to the story when Jim told it to me, because the way he told it was infused with all the kind of humor and love and joy that I think you see in the film. And it was so exciting to think about bringing people into this kind of untold history through a lens that was, you know, so fun and so kind of revolutionary. And then I grew up in the 70s. So for me, you know, once we found our way to that footage, it was full of nostalgia, but also the kind of optimism of that time, you know, that people could come together and really create a world or a future the way they wanted it to be. So it was just really kind of across time and working in collaboration with Jim and also a lot of the other people who are featured in the film that we kind of were able to kind of connect the dots and draw the line between that really profound experience of liberation in the camp and the, you know, disability rights movement that evolved throughout the 60s and 70s and eventually led us to the ADA.
There were some just amazingly engaging young future activists there, I guess, is the long and short of it.
Oh, yeah. Meeting Judy Heumann for the first time, you immediately recognize that she was this remarkable woman. And she was really my Pied Piper into the disability rights movement.
I mean, it was an optimistic time. Did you have this inkling that this could happen, or were you engaged politically as a kid?
Well, I was 15, so I, you know, barely knew what was going on around in the world in general.
Right.
But I, this was absolutely eye-opening. The fact that Judy had filed a suit and prevailed to get her teaching position with the New York City Board of Education was so profoundly eye-opening to me that we could actually, like, have rights or be able to sue to get the freedoms and the rights that everybody else had. I didn't even think, cross my mind, that that was possible. So it really, and I was fired up by the time I left that camp that summer and kind of continued to be. And certainly it was something I was holding on to as I went off to college also.
Coming up after a short break, Crip Camp gets an award season boost from a former president. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're revisiting our conversation with Nicole Newnham and Jim Lebrecht, directors of the Netflix documentary Crip Camp, which is now nominated for Oscar. Crip Camp tells the story of Camp Jened, a one-of-a-kind summer camp for disabled kids run by hippies in the early 1970s. In the film, disability rights activist and former camper Ann Cupolo Freeman remembers her first summer at the upstate New York camp.
I mean, when Woodstock was happening, I remember being at my grandmother's listening on the transistor radio and saying, wish I could go, wish I could go, wish I could go. And then when I went to Jened, it was like, there I was in Woodstock.
Crip Camp traces the path from the pretty grubby paradise of camp to the front lines of activism for the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which George H.W. Bush finally signed into law in 1990. Speaking of former presidents, when Netflix recently hosted a conversation on disability rights with the directors and stars of Crip Camp, just in time for Oscar voting, they were able to book a pretty well-known moderator.
When Michelle and I decided that we would, you know, get into the movie business, you know, we couldn't know at that time what stories would come our way. But I tell you, when we saw Crip Camp, we thought that is right in our wheelhouse. That is exactly the sorts of stories we wanted to see.
While Crip Camp ultimately gained the enthusiastic backing of the former First family, when directors Lebrecht and Newnham first sought funding for their film, they started with family.
We actually brought Jim's wife, Sarah Boulder, on board, and she's a fantastic producer. And we basically reached out initially to a lot of private individuals and foundations that we had personal connections to. And we also were supported by the Sundance Institute, who brought us to their documentary story and edit lab and gave us a grant. And then, you know, we were able to get some footage to Netflix and also to Higher Ground when they formed. And the Higher Ground principals, Priyaswami Nathan and Tonya Davis, came up and spent a bunch of time with us and looked at our footage. And so after a few hours, Priya went out and called us from the parking lot and said, you know, we're really excited to partner with you guys, and the president and Mrs. Obama feel the same way. And so that brought in the completion money that we needed to make the film, but also just this extraordinary partnership.
Did you have to be like, tell them we said hey, or do you get to meet Barack and Michelle ever in the process of this?
We think that we'll eventually wind up meeting them. There's nothing specific that we know about yet.
You're one degree of separation, so as far as I'm concerned, you know, you got to feel good.
We've spoken with him, and they did review several cuts and give us feedback and notes, which was amazing because
wow.
They have such an incredible perspective. And we continue to be so grateful that they see the importance of this story.
Oh, you're
less
than one degree of separation. You've phone met. I mean, I'm really trying to process the idea of getting notes from Barack and Michelle Obama. Do you
we
just
are
feel like whatever they say, I'm just going to do it? Or do you feel like you can push back on the Obamas?
Well, their notes were not prescriptive. Their notes were sort of questions raised or ideas given, you know, and we definitely felt like we had creative freedom and sort of the ability to finish the film the way we wanted to. But their entire team were really fantastic collaborators.
So you ultimately make the film and you end up at Sundance, well, and won the Audience Award, which congratulations, obviously. Tell me about that experience.
We were so excited because we got to bring about 8 or 9 of the people in the film to Park City to go to Sundance with us.
Mm.
That was thrilling, basically, to be with that whole cohort of people who really at the time, I think, the disability community didn't get the recognition that they deserved for having fought for this civil rights law that benefits everybody. I mean, everybody who ever pushes a baby stroller up a curb ramp,
right.
You know, can thank them, you know?
Me and my bad knees thank them, definitely, yeah.
Exactly. We just came from True False, where somebody at the end of a screening said, I just have one question. Why stairs? Why? So it was super thrilling to feel like folks were going to be there and be celebrated. And we came out on stage the opening night at the Eccles Theater, which is this massive theater. And when the lights came on after the film and you know, everybody, like 8 or 9 people from the movement were there on stage, there was this very long standing ovation. And that was a profound and beautiful moment, you know, for us to feel like that kind of recognition was finally dawning and carried over into the Audience Award, which was surreal and exciting.
I'm sure there wasn't a dry eye in the house. You got me pretty weepy there toward
Aww.
The end.
Sorry about that.
quite all right. It's good. It's cathartic. I need it. But I think that you were concerned. You wanted the story to be inspirational, but not in a way that felt maudlin.
Well, there's this whole kind of concept around inspiration porn when it comes to people with disabilities, where people are being praised for doing everyday things that non-disabled people think is a huge accomplishment, like putting your pants on. And
right.
But also knowing that we do want to inspire people to think about what their capabilities are in regards to being activists for what they see as in something important in this world. That certainly by example, you see that, a group of folks with disabilities could rally around and be incredibly savvy and make some incredible decisions and plans, and that they affected change that all of us enjoy today. So if you want to look at inspiration, it's not so much, gee, gol neds, you know, these handicapped people really did something here, but that, you know, change is possible and I can see how change is possible. Maybe I can do the same thing.
Jim Lebrecht and Nicole Noonan are the directors of Crip Camp. Congratulations on the film and thank you so much for coming in, notwithstanding multiple obstacles that have come in the way of our interview.
It's great to talk to you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with help this week from Desmond Taylor. Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business, as well as other great KCRW podcasts, on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.